This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, how'd everybody sleep last night? How'd you sleep?
I slept like a baby.
Did you?
I love getting a good night's sleep. It's my favorite thing.
Well, you are one of the lucky few. Not few, but there are a fair number of people in this world who don't sleep very well. And the surveys show that it's somewhere around 25% or so of people who don't sleep very well at night and therefore are tired during the day. So one of the questions that everybody asks is, how much sleep do you really need, and how do you know if you're getting enough sleep? Obviously, you have gotten enough sleep. You're chipper. You feel good. You said you slept all night. And if you don't get enough sleep, how does it affect your health? All important questions for a society where insomnia or difficulty sleeping is not all that uncommon.
That's right. Yeah. What did the invention of electricity do to sleep? That's what we need to find out.
Well, it ruined the whole thing.
It ruined the whole thing.
The candlelight worked better.
Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with two sleep and insomnia experts, Dr. Eric Olson of Mayo Clinic Rochester and Dr. Joseph Kaplan of the Mayo Clinic campus in Jacksonville, Florida. We'll get answers to the most common sleep questions, including, why do some people sleep better than others? It's not a contest. What qualifies you to be a true insomniac? How do you know if you're getting enough sleep? And are sleeping pills the answer, or are there better ways to help you get sleep? We'll also discuss what a sleep disorders center is and who should go there. How do you know if you have sleep apnea and how that can be treated?
You know, that's a huge problem.
Holy smokes.
So I'm glad we're going to talk about that.
Yep. And then we have a couple of lists here. A list of the five things you should do for a better night's sleep and the five things you should do if you have insomnia.
All right, so 10 things total.
10 things total, yep.
10 tips coming up. But first, this week, the FDA released the results of two federally funded studies which found links between testosterone therapy and heart problems in men. Now, these results come ahead of a public meeting on September 17th, which is planned to discuss the benefits and the risks of taking male hormone supplements. Joining us to discuss the testosterone question is Mayo Clinic urologist Dr. Landon Trost. Dr. Trost, good morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me on the program. I appreciate it.
So I'm glad we're going to talk about this because it seems like there are a lot of men who are taking testosterone supplements to improve whatever. Right?
All of the above. What does low testosterone mean, first of all?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Testosterone has really had a huge boom in recent years, really since about 1980 or so. And when you look at just numbers, you know, say from 2001 to 2011, the number of patients in the U.S. being treated for it tripled. And, you know, industry-wide, it went from about 18 million in 1988 to 1.6 billion in 2011. And even then, just last couple of years, it's still gone up about 77% or so. So,
wow.
So you're exactly right. It's been a huge increase in the volume of diagnoses and prescription, and your question as to, you know, what does it mean to have low testosterone, I think is one of the main debates and one of the main things that the FDA is pinpointing here. If you look at, say, men age 19 to 40, and you set the 2.5 percentile, meaning that if you look at 2.5% of the lowest levels, it ends up being about 350. But if you take that same standard and you apply it to men age 70 to 89, that number drops to 145. And so a lot of the debate is, does it matter that this is decreasing over time? Is just the fact that your number's lower, does that mean it needs to be supplemented or treated or not? And so that's part of the big debate, is it's very difficult to define what is truly a low testosterone in man.
Does it make it, I guess when I hear the commercials for these different products, I see commercials on television, whatever it might be, they just make it same. You don't feel like you used to feel,
yeah.
So you must, therefore you must have low testosterone.
Well, this is, you can understand why it's such a big industry, because the purported benefits are improving libido, improving energy, improving motivation, mood, concentration, difficulty sleeping, fat gain, decreased muscle mass.
So why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you take it? I mean, if it does all that, everybody ought to be taking it.
Well, and,
but it doesn't, you know, does it?
To some degree, they're right, but it's a very, very small percentage, and it really is the men who are very low on it. So if you look at studies that try to associate how common are these symptoms that are associated and due to low testosterone, those broad symptoms are really only about 5% of the time. So they're the minority of men, and those men tend to be the ones with very, very, very low testosterone, so say less than 100, less than even 50 for it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you can see why it's a big industry, though. The testosterone was grandfathered in by the FDA, so different companies don't have to do the same rigorous trials that you do for a new medicine. And now with direct-to-consumer marketing, you can put these out there, and everybody's convinced that they have it, and they come in wanting to be treated. You know?
The reason that we reached out to you is because of this FDA releasing of these. There's these two studies that showed a link between testosterone therapy and heart problems, and that's what they're going to talk about at this meeting on September 17th. But what do you think about that?
So there were probably the original study that brought some attention to this was in 2010 by Vosseria's group, and it was the first randomized controlled trial in men who had heart disease. And in this group, they found a higher rate of cardiovascular complications in the treatment group and not in the placebo group. Hmm. They immediately stopped the trial, and it brought up some controversy. When they looked back at that data, they found that the placebo group didn't respond like it normally should have, and this was likely just a spurious finding of it. But since then, more recently, there were two additional studies which came out, which again brought this idea of an association between men receiving testosterone having a higher rate of cardiovascular events. But those two studies, there are a lot of people who are very concerned with the findings because one of the studies, the absolute numbers were opposite of the author's conclusion. It was through statistical manipulations that they said, no, actually, the results are opposite of our generic. And they also excluded a huge number of patients who'd had a heart attack that should have been included in the placebo group. Hmm. So there's a lot of debate as to whether or not that's true or not. And there are also a couple other retrospective studies that show that testosterone supplementation increases longevity, reduces the rate of cardiovascular events. So it's kind of a hodgepodge right now. And until they have a long-term randomized controlled trial in a high-risk group, that won't be answered.
So it's really, really up in the air with regard to potential side effects. But
yep.
the only people, in your opinion, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but let me ask you, first of all, there's no reason to be taking testosterone supplements either over-the-counter or by prescription unless it's proven that you have low testosterone. Is that correct?
That is correct. So Isidore is go ahead.
All right, and how do you find out? There's only one way to find out if you have low testosterone for sure, and that's to be tested, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, so no reason to take all the over-the-counter medications that we see advertised on the TV unless you have low testosterone, and the only way to find that out is to go see you and get a blood test.
That's correct. And we also recommend getting two blood tests because there is quite a bit of variability just in the test itself, and even then, their society... guidelines that have set out standards by which they would, or numbers that they would recommend for treatment for it. So most providers will generally follow those guidelines.
Are there specific reasons, specific symptoms that would suggest to a man that he ought to come in and get tested? It's not a routine kind of test, correct?
No, and we don't recommend, and no society recommends routine screening for testosterone. But in certain populations, so those who have anemia, those with osteopenia or osteoporosis or kind of weaker bones, those with low libido, erectile dysfunction, that tends to be a group that has a higher rate of low testosterone. And also, even those with diabetes often may benefit from treatment if it's low because it does reduce insulin sensitivity, strengthens bones, so it does treat some of these other conditions.
Well, in general, if you're not feeling like yourself, you should go and see your doctor anyway. So this could be one of the things that you take a look at.
I think that's great advice. Yeah.
All right, Dr. Landon Trost, urologist, Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you again for having me.
You bet. Time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with sleep and insomnia experts Dr. Eric Olson and Dr. Joseph Kaplan, plus this myth or matter of fact. During sleep, your brain rests.
My brain never rests.
We'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our sleep experts, 507-282-1234, or tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and this week's guests, both sleep experts in studio, Dr. Eric Olson from the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Olson, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And joining us by telephone from the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, Dr. Joseph Kaplan. Dr. Kaplan, good to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning to you and thanks for having me.
All right, let's start out with the first obvious question. How much sleep do you really need and how do you know if you're getting enough?
Dr. Olson, we'll start with you. How much sleep do you need?
So that can vary on circumstances, but what I usually tell patients is you're likely getting enough sleep if you're awakening spontaneously in the morning, you feel refreshed by the sleep you obtained, and your level of alertness is to your satisfaction during the day.
That seems so easy when you say it like that.
But it varies, doesn't it, from person to person?
It does. You know, just like musical skill or athletic skill, sleep skill varies, you know, across individuals. And so rather than aiming for a specific target for everyone, there really has to be individual differences taken into account.
Is that why, Dr. Kaplan, they say, you know, you should get between 7 or 6.5 and 8 hours of sleep a night? So they give us that great big window?
Well, actually, the research shows that the healthiest individuals sleep around 7.5 hours per night to 8. But we don't know if those who sleep too little or too much are that way because they have some underlying conditions that either limit their ability to sleep or make them sleep too much. So just as Eric has mentioned, it really depends on the individual. It's somewhat genetically determined. And it really sometimes it's hard to find out what your true sleep requirement is. I advise patients to take some time off, a week or two, and not wake up to the alarm clock. Allow themselves to see what amount of sleep makes them feel the best during the day. And that's one of the ways to determine what you really need.
So just don't set the alarm. Go to bed at the same time every night and then just see after a couple of days when you wake up.
Exactly.
Okay, you said the genetic piece of it, so then I have to ask, are there people who are super sleepers that really only need 5 hours or 6 hours of sleep a night, or are they just trying to fool themselves?
That's a good question. I truly believe there are people genetically fit to sleep only 4 or 5 hours a night, and there are others who clearly require 9.5 or 10 hours of sleep.
Well, now that's interesting because Dr. Olson and I were discussing this before the program, and I said I'm gonna hit you with this myth or matter of fact, and it's some people function perfectly on 4 hours of sleep a night. You suggested yes, he put myth.
Yeah, I don't want to cause a controversy here. I think
we do. Let's go.
Yeah,
I think Joe and I would agree that. The true high functioner on 4 hours of sleep is a rare individual. Studies have shown that for average individuals, although there may not be an accumulating sense that I'm getting impaired or getting sleepier when sleep is restricted to 4 hours, you can show that impairment is dropping. So that would be across a generic group. There probably are rare individuals that can get by, but 4 would be hard to argue for the average person.
All right, myth or matter of fact, people in general, on average, are getting 20% less sleep than they did 100 years ago.
Dr. Kaplan, is that true?
Oh, I think it's true that, you know, the average American worker probably gets, according to the National Sleep Foundation, about 6 hours and 40 minutes of sleep, and it's probably not 100 years ago. It's much less than even 15 or 20 years ago, and so there's no doubt about it. American workers are getting much less sleep than they used to.
And what difference did electricity make to people's sleeping schedules?
Well, you know, the 24-hour cycle, the requirement for jobs that go 12 and 14-hour shifts, the availability of media and services 24 hours a day, and the pressure to work and be productive have really hurt the sleep schedule.
Sure.
There was a recent study where they put research subjects in what they called a Stone Age environment. So this was, you know, without all of our modern conveniences. And the subjects all gradually, what we say, advanced their sleep time, meaning they sure. went to bed earlier and their sleep duration lengthened.
I remember once hearing a thing about, you know, don't go into the kitchen and eat anything after 7 o'clock, and something along the same lines with your devices, your smartphones or iPads or anything like that, that you should start shutting them down a lot earlier in the evening than you think you should. Why is that, Dr. Kaplan?
Well, I think there's two reasons. Your brain is engaged and you're very active when you're on. I've had many patients who play games on their iPads and computers until late hours of the night, or are doing emails. And the other thing, there's a suspicion that the light coming from the device may actually trick your biologic rhythm into thinking that it's daytime, and then that would delay your ability to follow the normal biologic rhythm, which is to get sleepy and fall asleep in the late evening.
Speaking of the brain, what does the brain do while we're sleeping? What is happening over the course of the night? Dr. Kaplan, go ahead.
This is a mystery in science, exactly what goes on, but we know that the brain goes through a certain, that during sleep we go through a certain stages of what we call sleep architecture, and that intermittently throughout the night we enter a sleep called rapid eye movement sleep, which is a totally different state of being. During rapid eye movement sleep, the brain is extremely active, but the muscles are all made to be limp, essentially paralyzed, so that we don't actually perform the activities that are going on in this brain that's very, very active during dreaming. And I think it's pretty much known that the sleep is a time to restore both muscle function, improve your immune system, help with memory, mood. So without sleep at night, you know, these things will suffer.
So there are people who have difficulty sleeping, and then there are true insomniacs. How do you define an insomniac, Dr. Olson?
Well, you know, there's a scientific definition where if it takes you more than 30 minutes or so to fall asleep in an adult, or you're sleeping for under 6 hours and you feel the need for more. But for a typical patient, it's really just a sense of dissatisfying sleep. So the time that you're budgeting for sleep does not allow you to sleep either as long as you'd like or as sustained as you'd like.
Who's at risk for being an insomniac?
Yeah, there are certain types of patients that are more at risk. For instance, women seem to be more prone to insomnia than men. Individuals from a lower socioeconomic status tend to be more afflicted by insomnia than those in an upper status. Those that are having marital or relationship difficulties are definitely prone, people with high stress occupations as well. And then a strong link between individuals with psychiatric diseases are prone to difficulties with sleeping at high rates.
So one of the ways, if you think you may be suffering from insomnia, is to go to a sleep disorders center. Right, Dr. Kaplan? And tell us about that. Who's a candidate for that center and what goes on there? And you have one, I think, in Jacksonville, and we have one here in Rochester also.
Yeah. Tell us about that,
right.
Dr. Kaplan.
Right. Well, you know, there have been a proliferation of sleep disorder centers all over the country. And really, they're designed to evaluate the complex sleep problem or the sleep problem that's associated with serious medical consequences such as sleep apnea. I think everyone should start with their family physician and to try to figure out if there are some other medical issues that might be interfering with sleep. There's lots of information on the web regarding sleep disorders and sleep disturbances. And then I think it would be up to the primary care doctor to make a referral to a sleep specialist, who may or may not be located at a sleep center, usually affiliated certainly with a sleep center. And then the patient who requires a more in-depth evaluation to really determine what's going on with both the quantity and quality of their sleep might require an overnight visit to a sleep disorder center.
What's your success rate of the people that come to you that are referred to you who have sleep problems? How many of them do sleep a lot better after they leave your center?
Well, I think
take your advice.
Yeah, well, I think we can offer some improvement. We certainly don't offer cures to everyone. We can offer at least some improvement to almost every patient. And the patients who have undiagnosed obstructive sleep apnea, especially the moderate and severe cases, almost all of those patients can benefit enormously from treatment.
Isn't it fair to say also that there are people who just never learned how to sleep correctly, just like you don't learn how to eat healthy or you don't learn how to do the correct way to do exercises or whatever, that you can learn better sleep skills? Dr. Kaplan, go ahead.
Well, I think that most people are not born with problems sleeping, although there are a few who are genetically just not good sleepers. But I think what happens is habits develop that are what we call maladaptive. So something interferes with your sleep, or you're staying up late because you're studying, or you had to work night shifts, and all of a sudden you're not in a regular pattern. You've gotten used to drinking too much coffee. You do use alcohol in the evening. You're just not developing the kind of habits that promote good sleep, and then it results in long-term sleep difficulties.
Dr. Olson?
Yeah, some people talk about the three P's when it comes to insomnia, that we all have certain predisposing characteristics that might make us at risk, and then something precipitates poor sleep, like a crisis of some sort, and then either the insomnia clears and we return to normal sleep, or we develop these perpetuating or maladaptive factors that Joe talks about that then just entrench the problem.
Sure.
All right. We are talking with sleep experts Dr. Joseph Kaplan and Dr. Eric Olson. You know, when we come back, we're going to talk about non-drug alternatives for the treatment of insomnia, plus sleeping pills. What are the side effects if they're a reasonable option to help you sleep? Snoring, and of course, sleep apnea. Plus, we've got 10 things you can do to improve your sleep. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests, both sleep experts, Dr. Eric Olson and Dr. Joseph Kaplan. Coming up, This Week Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams.
Plus, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234. Tweet us your questions, too, at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We've got a lot of those coming in. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Dental implants. Lots of people have them, and here's some information about those implants and certain medications for depression. The International and American Associations for Dental Research report selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, which are the most widely used drugs for the treatment of depression, reduce bone formation and can increase the risk of bone fracture. They looked at this association between SSRIs and the risk of failure in dental implants. Their study showed that, yes, in fact, SSRIs are associated with an increased failure risk for these implants. The study was published in the Journal of Dental Research. And now let's talk about cancer surgery. How well patients recover may be influenced by more than the operations themselves. Family conflicts and other problems may raise the risk of surgical complications. Addressing quality of life issues before an operation may reduce stress, speed recoveries, and save healthcare dollars. A Mayo Clinic study found colon cancer patients with a poor quality of life were nearly 3 times more likely to have serious complications. Here's Dr. Julianne Binginer.
We're understanding much better now that patients are not just a body with a disease. There's a whole person with that and everything placed together. Years ago, we were just concerned with survival because survival was so difficult. Now we know survival is possible. Now we want to have it in a way that we have the right treatment at the right time for the right patient in an experience that allows their normal life to be diminished as little as possible, and the more we can help them to get through whatever they need to get through in a whole person fashion, then that's what we want to do. And we think that that's probably also the most economical way to go.
And this study was published in the Journal of Gastrointestinal Surgery. Okay, this one could be straight out of a science fiction movie. An international team of researchers have demonstrated that direct human brain-to-brain communication could work. They say they wanted to find out if people could communicate with each other by reading out brain activity from one person and injecting it into another across great distances.
without talking, using existing communications pathways. So one such pathway is, of course, the internet. They say it's like the neuroscientific equivalent of instant messaging. So get this. They successfully transmitted the words hola and ciao in a computer-mediated brain-to-brain transmission from a location in India to a location in France using very high-tech equipment. Now, previous studies show this could potentially be used to help someone who is disabled send signals to a computer that could then control a wheelchair. The study opens up other human communication possibilities. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online, and we're also on iHeartRadio. And you can listen live by going to our flagship station's website at krocam.com. Click Listen Live.
It's time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us by phone at 507-282-1234 or tweet out your question at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
I want to get into myth or matter of fact. Your sex at night will only arouse you and keep you up. Myth or matter of fact, Dr. Olson.
Dr. Olson, he's giving
I think
to
Dr.
you.
Kaplan.
Oh, boy. Actually, we got this question on a previous radio show. But anyway, no, that's a myth. I think that's a myth.
Oh, thank you,
we'll
Dr. Kaplan.
With that.
You second that, Dr.
I agree.
Olson?
Yeah, I agree.
Let's go to the phones. Arlie has a question about the size of his neck. Good morning, Arlie. What's your question about?
Well, I just had a MnDOT certification exam, and they suggested that I get a sleep apnea test due to my neck size. And my question is, how does that determine whether I have a sleep problem or not?
That's an awesome question. Dr. Olson?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So neck circumference can be relevant for predicting risk for a specific sleep disorder called sleep apnea, which means that when you're sleeping at night, you have these temporary breath pauses. And the most common reason you could pause your breathing during the night is that your neck literally relaxes to such a degree that the flow of air is blocked temporarily. And that's relevant for someone like you in a safety-sensitive position because it can lead to drowsiness during the day. So if you have a larger neck, that can predict a greater likelihood of that throat and upper airway narrowing critically at night, leading to snoring and then ultimately to sleep apnea.
So is apnea snoring and snoring is apnea, or are they two different things?
So they're just different points along the same spectrum. Snoring is a result of the airway narrowing, but not quite being closed. So as you breathe, the air creates a turbulent vibration to the upper airway structures. And when I say upper airway, I mean the throat. And that's a sign that the airway is narrowed. Apnea means that the breath has temporarily completely stopped or nearly stopped because that throat has continued to collapse down to the point of blockage. And that's not healthy, and it can lead to, among other things, feeling non-restored by your sleep.
Is neck size by itself a risk factor for sleep apnea?
So precisely, it's a risk factor in individuals whose total body weight is greater than ideal. So you can't apply that to everyone, but in an individual whose weight is heavier than ideal, then in men, a neck circumference greater than 17 inches, or in women, if it's measured greater than 16 inches, is a predictor for sleep apnea.
Arlie, do you feel like you are fully restored when you wake up in the morning, or are you kind of groggy?
No, I feel very restored. I sleep about 6 to 7 hours a night, and I don't have any problem getting to sleep. So, no, I feel very restored all day.
Excellent.
All right, and we won't ask you how much you weigh, Arlie, but if you're a little bit overweight and your neck is 17 or more, you might want to take this seriously. But it sounds like you're sleeping pretty well. Thanks so much for your call.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so sleep apnea, gold standard for treatment still the CPAP machine?
Correct. So the CPAP device is just a machine that uses air pressure to pneumatically hold open the throat during sleep, much like when you just inflate a low car tire and pump it up with air. There are other modalities, so we're using more and more of things like mouthpieces to hold the jaw forward. For the listeners, sometimes the image of the comedian Jay Leno can help explain what those do, so it holds
his
the jaw.
His jaw comes out.
Yeah, in
okay.
that forward position. And certainly working on risk factors, like with the last caller, if there's concern about weight and that neck circumference, working on weight loss loss or certain surgeries as well.
All right, 507-282-1234. Sleep experts Dr. Eric Olson and Dr. Joseph Kaplan.
Now, I asked both of these gentlemen to give me five things you can do if you have insomnia. And one of them, they both sent me five lists. And they weren't the same. And I thought, we have to do both of them. So that's why we have 10. But let's talk about Dr. Olson. Your list that you sent me basically was five things to do to get better sleep. So what are those five things that you suggest?
So the five I suggested were, number one, creating a comfortable environment for sleep. So one that's quiet, cool, and dark. The second tip I recommended is just practicing healthy living in general. Maybe the most important thing within that would be watching your exercise and make sure you're active during the day and limiting caffeine.
Getting more exercise will help you sleep better at night, of course.
Yes, and specifically if that exercise is timed maybe later in the day, not too close to bedtime, but perhaps later in the afternoon or very early evening may be ideal.
Okay.
But certainly any exercise better than none.
Right.
Third point I made was trying to limit your napping. Mm-hmm. I think for some insomniac patients, there's a tendency to compensate for a poor night's sleep by then having extended naps during the day. If we keep those naps brief, they're okay, but longer may be a danger sign. The fourth point was just finding time each day to unwind or relax and helping kind of clear your mind at night from those things that might seemingly be keeping it active. And then the fifth thing I said is just developing a bedtime ritual. And perhaps that extends this idea of relaxing, getting your body ready and trained to fall asleep rather than hitting, you know, bed going 100 miles an hour.
That's what you do for babies. You have the baby's nighttime routine that lulls them into sleep. It's the same thing for adults.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. We have a couple of tweets that we should probably get to. We have one that says, I feel sleepy all the time. Tea isn't working. Can you suggest some other stimulants? He needs to prepare for some exams that he's got coming up. So, wow, there's a lot of opportunities there. Dr. Kaplan, what do you think for this question?
Yeah, there's no substitute for sleep. So I think the individual needs to look very carefully at how much sleep they're getting. I think that strategic napping can sometimes help with alertness when someone has to study. The research tends to suggest that shorter naps are better than longer naps, naps between probably 10 and 30 minutes. If you have to drive and you're feeling sleepy, one strategy is to take caffeine in the form of a cup of coffee and then immediately take a 10 or 20 minute nap, because the caffeine takes about 20 or 30 minutes to work.
Yeah, I just heard that this week, that you drink the coffee, take the 20 minute nap, and then when you wake up, you've got a double dose
exactly.
of what's going right.
That's exactly correct.
That's awesome.
Okay, thanks for your comments. I want to ask you quickly about sleeping pills, because this is an issue that always comes up, both prescription and over-the-counter. How do you guys feel about prescription sleeping pills?
Maybe I'll start, Joe. My feeling is that, like anything, there's a role, an appropriate role for sleeping aids, but it's not a treatment for everyone. And I think, by and large, most insomnia can be addressed with non-drug approaches. I think there are some individuals that do, either on an as-needed basis or nightly, requiring a sleeping aid. But I think that's the exception rather than the rule. And for many people, the risks that come with that long-term use, I think, outweigh the benefits.
And what would those risks be?
So I think they're varied. For a lot of people, the most obvious is just feeling hungover in the morning, that drug casts a shadow on your alertness during the day. I think as people get older or have issues regarding their walking, another big risk is falls at night when you're under the influence of a drug that's making you sleepy.
Is there a sleepwalking danger too?
Right. So the very commonly used sleeping aid Ambien has been reported to be associated with various sleepwalking and activities at night for which the user is just not aware of or doesn't remember. And that can sometimes take the form of sleep eating during the night.
Sleep eating. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, you might fall down on the way to get the food,
oh,
too.
Oh, boy.
That's a problem. So what's your favorite non-prescription way to help people sleep, other than those things you have just told us? And you talked about behavioral therapy, I think, is on the top of your list.
Right. My advice usually starts with something that we call stimulus control, which means maneuvers that are designed to help the sufferer from insomnia start to reassociate the bedroom with success rather than failure.
Oh.
And so usually we talk about getting individuals out of the bedroom if they're not sleeping. And so they don't just lie there and build frustration, look at the clock, which only serves to reinforce some of those negative feelings. So leaving the bedroom, engaging in something not particularly interesting until that drowsiness returns, and it will, and then going to the bedroom and falling asleep, all the while making sure you keep your morning time the same so you don't sleep in to compensate for that time you were awake.
All right, we better go to the phones. The lines are full.
Well, I have to say, too, though, I did this tweet from Logan. How much sleep should a college student get? Age 20, Dr. Kaplan, how much sleep should a college kid be getting?
Yeah, well, college kids and their sleep habits present us with a great challenge. Mostly adolescents do require a little more sleep than adults, perhaps 8.5, 9 hours of sleep. So when is the transition from adolescence to adulthood? You know, somewhere in the probably in the early 20s. You know, once again, it all depends on the amount of sleep you need is what allows you to function at an optimal level during the day, feeling alert and restored. If you're not getting that, then you're not sleeping enough.
All right.
One line open, 507-282-1234.
All right, let's go to the phones. Good morning, Gordy. Welcome to the program. Go right ahead with your question.
Good morning.
Okay, go ahead.
Great. About a shrinking bladder, like I'm urinating too often, and then I'm old and obese, and I'm wondering what to do about that. And then I'm thinking prostate potential.
Well, what is your question?
Well, I'm just wondering if this is, I don't get into that deep REM sleep because I'm have to wake up 2 or 3 times in the middle of the night, et cetera. They know what I'm talking about.
Dr. Kaplan?
Yeah, well, this is a, thank you for the question. It's an excellent question, and this is a common presentation. Older men who come to us with getting up many times during the night, their sleep is disturbed by their need to empty their bladders. And in many cases, they've been treated for prostatism, but actually many of these patients have moderate or severe obstructive sleep apnea, which changes the way the kidneys function and produces more urine flow. So when we treat their sleep apnea, the need to get up at night drastically goes down. It doesn't go down in every single patient because the prostate enlargement with age might be a factor. But clearly, if someone is overweight and getting up a lot at night, I think sleep apnea should be looked for.
All right. Thank you for that question. Let's go to Beth has a question about aromatherapy. Good morning, Beth. What is your question?
Top of the morning, team. Hello. I have been diagnosed with restless leg syndrome. I kick like a doggone mule, but I've found a wonderful way to be able to handle this. Having had the prescriptions where you become very lethargic and it's an awful feeling. So my physician, my specialist here in Rochester, has prescribed a wonderful medication, Rapinoril. That's at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. To complement that, right before I go to bed, I have devised a very passive way, and each, almost every night, it differs. I will do the light therapy. And if light therapy, and gentlemen, you're the experts, would you elaborate, please, on that? And then I also am using a lavender as kind of a panacea.
Lavender oil.
And it seems to turn, the oil, that's correct.
Sure.
And it seems to turn the wheels off. I get REM sleep, but each night is almost different.
Dr. Olson, does something like aromatherapy work and help someone, or with a light therapy too?
Well, a couple of issues there. I would be a little wary about bright light right before bed. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about use of electronic devices in the minutes or hours leading up to sleep. So I think if the goal is to delay your onset of sleep, which can be an issue as people get older, then light in the evening or before bed is okay. For the average person, maybe a note of caution there, though, however. The aromatherapy, certainly it works for some individuals. The scientific data, you know, are thin. But I think if it's something that's a part of a ritual.
Yeah, it's all part of that routine.
Yep, right. That routine, then I'm all for it. And if it's working for you, Beth, great.
All right, just a quick question. The medication that she was taking for restless leg, which is a common problem, is that the preferred medication?
Right. So Ropinirole, or Requip is the name that drug also goes by, is one of several of the main class of drugs we use, which replace a compound called dopamine in the system. So ropinirole would be a first-line drug for restless legs.
Okay. All right. We've got some more calls to get to, but I want to give Dr. Kaplan a chance to go his five things to do for insomnia. Do you have your list there, Dr. Kaplan, or should I read it for you?
I do have it here.
All right. Give us those five things.
Okay. Number one, get off the iPad, computer, or backlit screen at least an hour before bedtime and avoid it in the middle of the night if unable to sleep. Number two, if you start worrying about problems at bedtime, develop a worry list, something that you would work on earlier in the evening where you identify the issues that are bothering you and identify potential solutions so that you unload these anxieties before bedtime.
Okay.
Number three, turn the clock away from your line of vision to avoid watching. Noting the time frequently at night is really counterproductive. It just puts more pressure on you to sleep. Number four, reduce the time in bed. Too many people spend time both before they fall asleep and in the middle of the night just struggling to sleep. Get out of the bedroom and reduce your time in bed. Number five, keep a relatively rigid wake-up time 7 days a week. And that's my list.
That's the one that my preteen doesn't appreciate so much.
Great list.
Hardly any preteens do.
Let's go back to the phone. Sue has a question. Good morning, Sue. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
I'm an elderly lady, and I go to bed about 10:15, and I wake up about 3 o'clock to go to the bathroom, and I can't get back to sleep.
Oh, it's a habit.
Do you have any good idea about how I can go back to sleep?
Dr. Kaplan?
Yeah. Let's get these guys to answer this question.
Yeah.
So thanks for calling.
You know, as we all age, sleep tends to change somewhat. We don't take sleep in one good 10-hour block like an 8-year-old would. Sleep becomes fragmented. And these early morning awakenings are a big problem. Sometimes it's due to a condition called advanced sleep phase syndrome, where the biologic clock wants to put people to sleep early in the evening at 8 or 9 o'clock. They get very, very sleepy, and then at 3 or 4 in the morning, they're wide awake. Sometimes treatment with bright light, as Eric mentioned, can help delay the sleep phase. Sometimes early morning awakening is a sign of depression. So if there's anything wrong with mood, you might want to check with your doctor to see if that might be the issue. It's the biggest problem is there's nothing going on at 4 in the morning. People feel like they should be sleeping later. But if you're functioning well during the day, I wouldn't put pressure on yourself. I would just try to maybe delay your bedtime and consider talking to someone about bright light in the evening if you're someone who tends to be very sleepy at 8 or 9 o'clock and wide awake at 3 or 4 in the morning.
Well, thank you so much for your question. We have more questions here, so we'll ask you to hold after the show, Dr. Olson. Maybe you can talk to some of these other callers. Do people in general need to get more sleep as we finish here, Dr. Olson, or are we doing all right?
Absolutely. I think the average American is sleep deprived.
Very good.
All right, Dr. Eric Olson, Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and Dr. Joseph Kaplan, Mayo Clinic, Jacksonville, Florida. Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate all the great advice and especially the tips.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great to be with you.
All right. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we're going to tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. We want to tell you about next week's program, but first we'll finish up with a couple of items on sleep.
Right. Both of the doctors had given me information, a website that they use for help with insomnia. And the first one is CBTforinsomnia.com. And the other one is Shut I. That's the letter I. So shuttheletteri.com.
We'll put those on our website.
Yep, we will put those on the website. We'll tweet them out. They do have a fee that goes with them, but they are programs that can help you with insomnia virtually.
Really?
How wonderful is that?
I wonder how much that costs. Well, whatever it is, it's worth it to get a good night's sleep.
If you get insomnia, that's right.
I bet it's not that expensive. All right, next week we will talk with infectious disease specialist Dr. Pratish Tosh. We'll get an update on the Ebola virus, find out if we need to be worried about that. We'll talk about hospital-acquired infections. Why are they so common? I mean, that's a pretty sterile place.
You'd think.
Infections are a problem there. Is hand-washing really all it's cracked up to be? And we'll talk about the potential for a pandemic from something, MERS or novel influenza virus or whatever.
Scare the heck out of you.
No, we won't do that. Why and when might it happen? Ebola Ebola and other infectious diseases next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on and more more website information, too, discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, for a podcast of today's program, or go to mayoclinic.org for more information from over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, sitting in for Audrey Castletine, Chris Ryan. Our technical director is Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.